It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Let's start out with the Buffalo Field Campaign update from the field. Wild buffalo have returned with the spring. The song of mountain bluebirds is in the air, and tracks of the mighty bison are upon the land once again after a long winter without buffalo in Montana. The unspoken question hung in the air: would the buffalo return this year? Wild forces prevail, and on the vernal equinox, the steady, determined footsteps of approximately 50 buffalo made their way down the Madison River corridor out to their calving grounds on Horse Butte, heralding the season of rebirth. The buffalo's return has raised the spirits of everyone in camp. The energy is palpable, and we are once again running full patrols and basking in the presence of these prehistoric wonders. Of course, the Montana Department of Livestock also knows the buffalo are here, and the local Montana Department of Livestock agent Shane Grube is keeping a watchful eye on every move they make. Change is afoot, however, and right now the buffalo on Horse Butte are being left alone. In December, as a direct result of your persistence, the Interagency Bison Management Plan agencies signed a new adaptive management plan, which states that an unlimited number of buffalo are allowed to occupy Horse Butte until May 15th, and with other agency-defined numbers of buffalo tolerated on lands north and south of the Madison River. The new rules don't respond to the natural movements or behaviors of wild buffalo, so the agents, by drawing more lines in the sand, have set them up to fail. Simply crossing a creek or river or having one too many buffalo in a group could trigger severe management actions against them. Further, everything is up to the discretion of Montana's state veterinarian, who could decide at any time to scrap the minimal tolerance. So we are, as always, monitoring the buffalo's migration and watching every move the agents make to ensure that they uphold this new tolerance they've agreed to, while we continue to push for the buffalo's right to make their own decisions. But at the moment, according to the agency's new plan, the buffalo on Horse Butte are immune to agency action. Family groups with multiple generations are enjoying the fresh spring shoots of grass they've waited for all winter. Buffalo of all ages, including expectant mothers, are taking in the warmth of the waxing sun and the goodness of nutritional spring grasses, and whether or not they know it, they have put a bright gleam in our eyes and quickened the beating of our hearts. Volunteers are needed on the front lines with Buffalo Field Campaign. With the buffalo's migration finally underway, we are in need of volunteers for both spring and summer. If you've ever wanted to experience the splendor of the Yellowstone ecosystem, this is the way to do it. Whether joining us on the front lines for the first time or as a returning volunteer, we need you. Buffalo Field Campaign is looking for folks for our spring field season and for summer in the summer months when our volunteers run our outreach tables in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. There are many ways to plug in at Buffalo Field Campaign in the field, in our offices, and around the property. Opportunities abound, and any skills you can bring, we can put to good use. Help bear witness and strengthen the voice for wild buffalo. It is especially helpful if you have a valid driver's license and can drive a standard shift. Buffalo Field Campaign provides room, board, and training, and we can outfit you with necessary gear. If you are interested in volunteering this spring field season, please contact Brock or Will, our volunteer coordinators. Their email address, volunteer@buffalofieldcampaign.org, or give them a call at 406-646-0070, and I'll give you that number again in a minute. People interested in volunteering for our summer campaign should contact Mike at meas@wildrockies.org, or call, once again, that number, 406-646-0070. See you in West Yellowstone with the last of the last wild buffalo. If you want to reach the Buffalo Field Campaign or send them a donation, regular snail mail goes to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758, the zip. Once again, that phone number, 406-646-0070, and you can find all this information and more at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. Remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And coming up in a week or so is the Blue Ridge Earth First Spring Campout. Come one, come all to the Blue Ridge Earth First Spring Campout located in the countryside just west of Charlottesville, North Carolina. And that'll happen April 3rd through the 5th. Campout will include trainings in direct action and grassroots organizing skills led by Earth Firsters from far and near, workshops on permaculture techniques and primitive skills, and good fun in the beautiful and biodiverse Blue Ridge Mountains. While Earth First focuses on environmental action, we value solidarity and mutual aid among all our movements, working for justice. Towards realizing this vision of a more unified multi-cause movement, there will be trainings, campfires, skill shares, and strategizing about the Surrey County Coal Plant Campaign, regional anti-nuclear campaigns, and the Farmville Immigrant Detention Center. Spread the word far and wide and let us know if you're planning on coming. There will be trainings, campfire, skill shares, and strategize. Well, I thought we'd already... Oh, okay. I repeated that sentence. I don't know why. Email or visit our website to RSVP, ask questions, or get directions to the campout. Let's see here. The webpage is creator.zoho.com/JasonMJ/campout-registration. creator.zoho.com/JasonMJ/campout-registration. Thank you for your support and interest in our movement. This is a perfect opportunity to learn more. Hope to see you there. Blue Ridge Earth First. Their email address, blueridgeef@yahoo.com. And if you want to know more about Blue Ridge Earth First, visit their website, www.blueridgeef.com. All right. And a public land bill has passed. Now it's on its way to Obama for a signature. And this is addressed to Dear California Wilderness Coalition supporter. We are pleased to announce passage of the Omnibus Public Lands Bill. With your hard work and dedication in protecting California's wild lands, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the bill yesterday with a 285-140 vote margin. Thank you for helping the California Wilderness Coalition to protect over 700,000 additional acres of wilderness and wild rivers in California, including 115,000 acres of public land within the Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park, including Redwood Mountain Grove and Old Hockett Trail. And I may be looking at the Old Hockett Trail here before long myself. 200,000 acres in Riverside County, including additions to Joshua Tree National Park and the San Jacinto and Santa Rosa Mountains National Monument. More than 500,000 acres in Inyo, Mono, and northern Los Angeles counties, including the Eastern Sierra and White Mountain Ranges, and an additional 29,000 acres of ancient bristlecone pine forest. This is all great stuff. This is the largest designation of new wilderness since 1994. Legislation will establish a 26-million-acre national landscape conservation system that will help protect the crown jewels of the Bureau of Land Management, including more than 800 individual units, 15 national monuments, 13 national conservation areas, the Headwaters Forest Reserve in Northern California, 38 wild and scenic rivers, and 183 wilderness areas, and more than 5,100 miles of national scenic and historic trails. Additionally, the wilderness and other conservation designations in the Public Lands Omnibus Bill will provide additional economic benefits for rural communities across the United States. Passing this legislation will help local communities by providing new sources of revenue and support. The good jobs, increased property values, and healthy landscapes are important reasons why numerous California businesses and local chambers of commerce support the wilderness and other conservation provisions within the Public Lands Omnibus Bill. In the words of the Palm Springs Chamber of Commerce, wilderness and other protective measures are crucial for maintaining a healthy economy in rural areas. To ensure this bill is signed into law, please email, call, fax, or snail mail President Obama, urging him to sign the Omnibus Public Lands Bill. And a ban on the commercial fishing of Chinook salmon has been extended in this story by Peter Fimwright of the San Francisco Chronicle. The grim reality of a devastated salmon fishery hit home recently when the Pacific Fishery Management Council agreed to yet another ban on commercial fishing of Chinook salmon in California and Oregon. It is the second straight year that the sea salts who make their living off the fabled fall run of Sacramento River king salmon will be grounded. That includes fishermen here in the Santa Cruz area. None of the three options approved by the 14-member panel made up of fishing interests, tribal representatives, and conservation groups from California, Oregon, and Washington included any commercial fishing in the two states. The decision came after a week of testimony in Seattle that included mounting bad news about the California fishery. Severe restrictions and bans on sport fishing were also included in the package, which will be narrowed down to a final option early next month. "It's grim," said Dave Bitts, president of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. "The ocean conditions were supposed to have turned around and gotten a lot better, so I'm kind of baffled, frankly." The blame falls directly on the Central Valley fall run of Chinook. Only about 66,000 adult salmon returned to spawn last fall in the Sacramento and San Joaquin rivers. That, according to biologists, whose estimates are based on a count of egg nests in the riverbed. It was the lowest return on record. The collapse forced regulators to ban ocean salmon fishing in California and most of Oregon last year, the first time that that had ever been done. Fisheries biologists are projecting that the fall run of Chinook this year will be almost twice as plentiful as last, a fact that experts characterized as a thin thread of a silver lining. Still, the numbers will barely reach the council's minimum goal of 122,000 fish, even if there is no fishing, according to the projections. The council, which was established 3 decades ago to manage the Pacific Coast fishery, did include a little sport fishing in California in one of the options. If that option eventually gets approved, it could mean recreational fishermen could take Chinook between August 29th and September 7th, only in an area extending from the mouth of the Klamath River north into southern Oregon. All three options would allow some commercial and sport fishing of hatchery-raised coho salmon, identifiable because of the fleshy adipose fins have been removed on hatchery fish, and that would occur in Oregon during July and August. Chinook or king salmon pass through the San Francisco Bay and roam the Pacific Ocean as far away as Alaska before returning 3 years later to spawn where they were born in the Sacramento River and its tributaries. The fall run in September and October has for decades been the backbone of the West Coast fishing industry. At its peak, it exceeded 800,000 fish. Over the past decade, the numbers had consistently topped 250,000 until last year. The worst run on record was in 1992, when only 81,000 Chinook returned to spawn. Changing ocean conditions, diversions of fresh water in the Delta to cities and farms, pumping operations, and exposure to pollutants have all been trotted out as culprits in the demise of the salmon. Some fishermen believe ravenous sea lions are to blame, but most environmentalists have consistently pointed to increases in water exports out of the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta as the primary reason for the decline. Whatever the cause, more than 2,200 fishermen and fishing industry workers lost their job as a result of last year's ban. Fishing communities and fishing-related businesses lost more than $250 million. Indirect economic impacts were even larger, according to fishing industry representatives. Federal fishery scientists are expected to release a report on the possible reasons for the collapse, but it is already too late for the salmon this year. The council will make a final recommendation to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Service in early April. The final decision on the restrictions is expected to be made by May 1st. Restrictions on river fishing will be made at a later date by the California Department of Fish and Game, which allowed some 600 Chinook to be caught last year, angering many commercial fishermen who felt it was wrong to allow any fishing at all by anyone. And activists say that Canada's seal hunt target is excessive in this story by David Lundgren and editing by Rob Wilson. Canadians armed with rifles and clubs ventured out onto ice floes off the Atlantic coast on Monday to start the annual harp seal hunt, an event that opponents say is totally unjustified. Ottawa announced last Friday night that hunters will be allowed to kill 280,000 young harp seals out of a herd of 5.5 million, slightly more than the 275,000 limit set last year. Protesters say the hunt is unsustainable and unnecessary, given that the price for pelts is falling and the European Union is falling closer to a ban on the import of any seal products. I think it's outrageous at a time when we're seeing up to 100% mortality in sea pups born in key whelping areas. The Canadian government thinks it's appropriate to sign one of the highest quotas we've seen in recent years, said Rebecca Aldworth of the Humane Society of the United States. As I say, every year that we get high quotas like this, the last time that Canada allowed this many seals to be killed, nearly two-thirds of the harp seal population disappeared in the space of about a decade, she told Reuters News. Although most animals are shot, some are killed by blows from large spiked clubs called hackapicks. Animal rights groups often use graphic and bloody pictures of the clubbing as part of their campaign to halt the hunt altogether. The initial stage of the hunt takes place off the Madeleine Islands in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and is usually the focus of intense media interest. However, most of the seals are killed later off the coast of Newfoundland. The seals are hunted for their fur, meat, and oil, which is rich in omega-3 fatty acids. 2 years ago, the hunt was badly disrupted by a scarcity of the sea ice that seals give birth on. Canadian Fisheries Minister Gail Shea said Ottawa would defend the seal hunt, which she said was a significant source of income in many small, isolated coastal communities. Our management decisions for the hunt take into account this fact, as well as the advice of scientists to ensure the seal population is maintained, she said in a statement issued late Friday. Cheryl Fink of the International Fund for Animal Welfare said the real reason for the hunt is local politics in eastern Canada, where Shea is from. For the past 2 years, we've seen saturated markets for seal fur, and pelt prices are now the lowest in recent memory, Fink said in a statement. If this is a market-based hunt, as the government claims, the quota for this year should be zero. Our government is insisting on keeping Canada stuck in the dark ages. Russia last week said it had banned the hunting of baby harp seals, weeks after Prime Minister Vladimir Putin called it a bloody industry. And Sierra Pacific Industries has renewed its threat to the Underwood Forest in Northern California. In this story from Earth First Humboldt, notorious timber baron Red Emerson of Sierra Pacific Industries has filed a new logging plan in the native forest of Underwood Mountain. Their new plan aims to wipe out most of the remaining square quarter mile private inholding of forest land nestled in the public Underwood roadless area. Last year, SPI built a much-contested road through public old-growth forests in order to log this area. At that time, they hurriedly cut a portion of the forest under salvage logging loopholes in the environmental laws. Most of the forest remains standing. The tree species in the area are mostly Doug fir, oak, and pine. The forest is comprised of trees of all ages, some of the giants reaching over 200 years old. Last year, Earth First Humboldt attempted to stop the road building by occupying trees in the path of construction. We had to evacuate the area, however, after lightning strikes set fires nearby. As the fires advanced in the direction of the tree sits, dense smoke caused respiratory problems and ashes and burned leaves rained down from the sky. It was a privilege to witness this beautiful natural process, but we had to leave for fear of suffocating or being roasted. Sierra Pacific Industries is the largest private landowner in California with over 1 million acres of forest land ownership. This logging plan goes along with SPI's agenda of rapid clear-cutting and conversion of wild forests into tree plantations. If all goes well for SPI, they may be able to log this ancient wild forest this summer. We are watching and waiting for them. And this story came from Earth First Humboldt, and their webpage is efhumboldt.org. There's no W's in there anywhere, just efhumboldt.org. And New Hampshire Dam is removed. The city of Manchester, New Hampshire, is taking an important step towards fostering a more resilient community as construction began on the removal of the Maxwell Pond Dam on Black Brook. Faced with an aging dam that was exacerbating local flooding and threatening critical infrastructure, City leaders joined forces with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services and an array of partners to craft a comprehensive restoration project that will not only eliminate a safety hazard, but will also restore more than 7 miles of habitat for migratory fish and improve water quality in Black Brook. By the way, this is a press release from the City of Manchester. So if the tone is a little biased, that's why. State scientists expect that the improvement will allow Black Brook, a tributary of the Merrimack River, to be removed from New Hampshire's 303D listing of impaired waters. Maxwell Pond is currently on the list because it does not adequately support diverse aquatic life due to its low level of dissolved oxygen, which all aquatic life needs to survive. Formerly owned by the A.H. Maxwell of the Manchester Coal and Ice Company, the impoundment was once the source of what some considered the purest ice in Manchester. Unfortunately, over time, this once thriving stream has become a degraded, stagnant impoundment that supports only a few freshwater fish species. And that's warm water fish species. Removing the Maxwell Pond Dam will allow Black Brook to flow swifter and cleaner, greatly improving habitat for alewife, American eel, blueback herring, Atlantic salmon, and other migratory fish native to this area, said Eric Hutchins of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Restoration Center. The dam had also aggravated flooding. During past flood events, water had risen over the dam and flooded Front Street. As a result, several local businesses were forced to shut down and suffer losses. Flooding at this site has also threatened to undermine the busy Front Street Bridge. The situation at the Maxwell Pond Dam has the potential to become quite dire, as each flood also threatened the stability of a gas main spanning the channel, said Jim Gallagher, chief of the Dam Bureau of New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Thankfully, National Grid went above and beyond to relocate the gas main as part of this project, ensuring greater security for this vital component of Manchester's infrastructure. Well, bully for them. As part of the restoration project, the City of Manchester plans a major revitalization of the surrounding park, adding an educational kiosk and refurbishing the trail system. The project will provide better access for fishing and kayaking and help reconnect people to the outdoors. Soon, a healthy Black Brook will be a source of pride for our community. Manchester is not the only community facing the challenges presented by aging infrastructure. By 2020, more than 85% of our nation's dam will be older than 50 years of age, and that's their average life expectancy. Communities across New Hampshire and the country are realizing multiple benefits of improved water quality, revitalized fisheries, new recreational opportunities, increased real estate values, and recovered land suitable for parks and other public use by removing obsolete dams and restoring natural river functions. When we tear down old infrastructure like obsolete dams, we build up our natural infrastructure, the streams, wetlands, and floodplains that give our communities essential services like clean water, flood protection, and other economic benefits, said Rebecca Water, that's W-O-D-D-E-R, president of American Rivers. And here's our biodiversity news for this week. Southeast salamanders win 27,000 acres of habitat protection. Responding to legal action by the Center for Biological Diversity, Wild South, and the Florida Biodiversity Project, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has officially protected more than 27,000 acres of Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina habitat for the frosted and reticulated flatwoods salamanders. On the same day, acknowledging a recent study on the salamanders, formerly lumped together as the flatwood salamander, the service for the first time recognized that the amphibians as two separate species, going further to upgrade the reticulated flatwood salamander status from threatened to endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The salamander's habitat protections have already benefited the species. After the protections were first proposed, the U.S. Navy backed off of plans to sell land, providing important habitat for the reticulated flatwoods salamander. The reticulated flatwood salamander lives on the west side of the Apalachicola River drainage, while the frosted flatwood salamander lives on the east side. Both species, which boast flashy silver and black markings down their elongated bodies, are threatened by the destruction of pine/pine flatwoods, fire suppression, and urban and agricultural sprawl. The usual suspects. And the center has petitioned for scores of spring snail species. Try saying that really fast. An array of amazing, uncommon, and underappreciated invertebrates gained a following recently when the Center for Biological Diversity and the Freshwater Mollusk Conservation Society filed a scientific paper and petitioned to protect 42 spring snail species in Nevada, Utah, and California under the Endangered Species Act. All 42 snails depended on consistent groundwater flow in their Great Basin habitat, are imminently threatened by unsustainable groundwater pumping proposed by the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Because reductions in groundwater flow have an immediate impact on spring snails' populations, these sensitive mollusks are the perfect indicator of declining water tables, and they're just a fraction of the desert species that need adequate groundwater for survival. 14 of the snail species occur at a single location, and 39 others occur at 10 or fewer locations. Without the protection under the Endangered Species Act, these spring snails will be lost forever, said Rob Mrowka, I guess M-R-O-W-K-A, a conservation advocate with the center. Groundwater withdrawal, spring diversion, livestock grazing, and an array of other threats severely threaten these 42 spring snail species, along with other species that depend on desert springs. And the condor-killing Tejon sprawl plan moves nearer to a court battle. In defense of the California condor, 26 other rare species in one of the most unique areas of wildlands in California, the Center for Biological Diversity called for the withdrawal of the Tejon Ranch property's request for a permit to build a huge resort community smack in the middle of protected condor habitat. The natural wonders of Tejon Ranch, an astoundingly diverse 270,000-acre swath of land like nowhere else on Earth, are imminently threatened by the Tejon Mountain Village development in Kern County, which would convert tens of thousands of pristine acres of crucial condor habitat into a sprawling collection of houses, lawns, golf courses, golf carts, and stores. But the documents submitted with the plan request for the development were released hastily amidst much confusion and without proper scientific review, notably before the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had finished analyzing the use of Tejon Ranch by condors. The Center for Biological Diversity has requested that the permit request be delayed. Says Adam Keats, director of the center's Urban Wildlands Program, it's imperative that this behemoth, prepared in the waning days of the Bush administration and rushed into publication, needs to get adequate review by the Obama administration as well as the general public and the scientific community. And the wronged lynx now gains 25 million protected acres. The outlook for the threatened Canada lynx got about 20 times better recently when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service increased the species' federal habitat protections from 1,841 square miles to 39,000 square miles. That's 24.96 million acres. In acknowledgement of political meddling, the decision to reverse a 2006 habitat designation made under corrupt former official Julie McDonald, who resigned in disgrace after an ongoing investigation by the Inspector General revealed she was illegally pressuring federal biologists to reach conclusions favoring lucrative industries, in the lynx case, timber, over species preservation. Unfortunately, the new protected habitat designation leaves out parts of the lynx's historical habitat that should be safeguarded to allow the species to expand its range, including into areas in the southern Rocky Mountains. The majestic Canada lynx was protected under the Endangered Species Act in the year 2000 due primarily to threats from logging of their forest habitat. The species is also threatened by snowmobile traffic, trapping, and global warming. And the Northern Rockies fisher, a rare, shy, but decidedly plucky relative of the weasel, was thrown a potential lifeline when the Center for Biological Diversity and three allies filed a scientific petition to gain protection for the animal under the Endangered Species Act. The plush-furred mammal, similar to otters, minks, and martens, once roamed dense old-growth forests across the Rocky Mountains. the northern Rocky Mountains, daringly preying on snowshoe hares, birds, and even porcupines. Now, though still a tough customer, the fisher has experienced dramatic range loss and is even more elusive thanks to logging and trapping. And the Forest Service shuns a call to halt northeastern forest logging. In bad news for New England's beautiful White Mountain National Forest and the species that call it home, the U.S. Forest Service denied an official request by the Center for Biological Diversity and the Sierra Club to halt logging and road construction in one of the forest's most pristine wilderness areas. The Mill Brook Project proposed timber sale in the forest-protected Kilkenny roadless area in northern New Hampshire would degrade crucial wildlife habitat, including habitat for species stressed by climate change like the lynx and American marten. The project would also defy the roadless rule, Clinton-era law that demands protection for national forest roadless areas nationwide. Some individual national forests, while still operating in a 19th-century timber-cutting mindset and embroiled in local politics, are not able to see the national significance of protecting our last remaining roadless areas, said Molly Mattison, conservation advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity. We aim to change that, she said. For more information about the Center for Biological Diversity, visit their website at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And we thank them for all their diverse biological news. And that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a podcast of the Earth First Update, go to www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. Once again, www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we thank the folks at h2opodcast.com for recording and providing those shows for our listeners. I invite you to tune back in to the Earth First Update next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock, right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for listening.